Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drancier live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Canucks playoff coverage on Sportsnet 650 is brought to you by Merit Kitchens. Canadian-made beauty, strength, and craftsmanship. Find an authorized kitchen designer near you today at MeritKitchens.com. Your tailored kitchen awaits. Sean Gentile will join us momentarily here from The Athletic, our pal, to chat NHL playoffs. But it's happened again, Drance. The NHL has foolishly leaked the results of the draft lottery hours in advance.
Oh, man.
With a 100% degree of certainty.
We're doing it again, huh?
We're doing it again.
For the 19th year in a row.
Do we not understand that the networks rehearse this? Right? it's not fixed. It's a rehearsal. They're going through to make sure they know what to do. Anyways.
Yeah, the board. Make sure the board works.
Make sure the board works. Now joining us, as mentioned, from The Athletic, he is Sean Gentile. Sean, don't we do this every year with the draft lottery leaked early, or the expansion draft to Seattle leaked early? And then it's obviously never true because it's just rehearsal. Do we have to do this every May?
This all goes back to the initial NBA draft lottery in 86 or whenever it was.
85, I think. Patrick Ewing one. Yeah.
Whatever the Ewing lottery was, when everybody thought that David Stern was pulling the frozen envelope out of the stack. We're just feeling repercussions for that, 40 years later. I knew exactly what I phased in halfway through you guys talking about it. I know exactly what the topic is here. Yeah.
It's just, by the way, speaking of decades old NBA lore, if I reference the flu game to you, which player immediately jumps to mind?
Jordan.
Okay. Yeah. Drance insists that it should be Clyde Drexler.
The original flu game. Everyone knows this.
Oh, that was, I'm shocked. Well,
game five against the Rockets.
Start talking about,
it's a historic game.
Well, I mean, I also, you could call it the hangover game too.
Yes. We can get into that aspect of it as well. Also for sure. All right. So we are, we're in the middle of continuing to break down and preview the Canucks and the Oilers. Doesn't get going until tomorrow night. So we've had lots of time. I'm sure you've had lots of time to think about this as well. And, a big talking point here is how dare people disrespect and the Canucks and make them the underdog against the Oilers. How much of a chance do you see the Canucks having in this series against Edmonton?
What did Dom's model put him at?
26%, I think.
Or something.
Yeah.
I'll just go with that. I'll give them the exact number for what I don't know, man. I'm certainly more. I think they have. What are the odds at?
Seventy percent implied. I do. I know it off the top of my head. Canucks are +220 to advance, which is 30% implied probability. So very much in line with Dom's model.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll give him a little bit more than that. But I see people get upset, and it's like, how good of a chance do you actually think they have? Is it better than 50? Should we have even odds here? Someone's got to be the dog, and it's going to be the team that's starting a third string goaltender and has, depth players that are struggling more than the other team, and the team that doesn't have, the best player on earth. There's no way they're not going to be dogs coming into the series. So when I see, where the odds are set or whatever, I generally say that's about right, but whatever, man, that's why they play the games. I don't know.
Yeah. I also think the way that their both teams' respective first round series played out, colors this too. I mean, the Oilers ripped the Kings apart, and the Canucks kind of, I don't know, it felt like seized victory from the jaws of defeat in multiple games in a Predators series completely even.
We got the hit post. We have, we're a half. Two inches away from that game going to seven at best, right? So I don't somebody needs to be the dog. That's what I keep coming back to, and it's like That's the way it goes, right? Like every team, and this is something that you know it intellectually, but I've really seen it firsthand with having to do, getting forced to do playoff previews, but getting blessed to do playoff previews for every single series. Like every single fan base thinks their team is disrespected in every single series, right? Like nobody, there has never been a fan base who's come into a series as the underdog and been discussed about in those kind of terms. He says like, yeah, that's about right. Like generally it's people who are angry and frustrated and feel disrespected. And that's fine. Like that's their prerogative. That's the way fandom works. But man, somebody needs to be the dog. It's not just 50-50 in every series. Like we're dealing in observable reality here with stuff that's happened over the last couple months and in the couple months that preceded that, right? So I don't know, it's the way it's got to be. For whether that's fair or not, it's really like not even the point.
Beyond the model, beyond the gambling odds, your sense of how these two teams stack up, where does Vancouver have to be excellent if they're going to execute the underdog wins series script?
I think they need something magical to keep happening with sale odds, right? Like, isn't that it? Like, isn't that? And it's such a cop out to say that a series hinges on goaltending, but it feels like that's even more true now because this is a guy who we knew functionally nothing about, 10 days ago. So, can a dude who was a third stringer until a few days ago, keep it rolling and decide a series? Like, we're about to find out. And I think that's cool. I think that's really compelling. And I think that even though it sounds reductive to say, like, can C. Loves be the guy? I think that's it. If he can steal a game steal a game or two, then, things are going to get a lot more interesting. But you also can't pick Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl and, all these players to lose to a third string goaltender. Like it's not good business. it's not the most logical or likely outcome. So, I think there's two sides to it, right? But would I be psyched to see this continue and see T-Lobs go on some unconscious run where he has a 43 save game or whatever? Like, yeah, absolutely, sign me up for it. I just think you need to acknowledge that that's also not particularly likely.
Yeah, and as you said, look, that would be a great story. And the thing about the underdog conversation, the point I've made is like, isn't being the underdog way more fun, right? Because then if you do pull it off, it's an even more awesome, like it's way more fun to win as the underdog to win as the heavy favorite, right? Like that's a way cooler story if your team gets it done.
The idea of being able to go back and screenshot stuff and do the old take exposed bit and all that, that's like, that pays for itself. Like that's the fun. Like there's so much ammo to go back on and rub people's noses in it. If that's what it comes down to, that yeah, man, I'd be fine if I were a Canucks fan and I'm looking at Vegas saying it's 70-30 and other statistical models saying something similar. I'm like, yeah, this is great, and it's time to watch the games and hope to get a couple breaks and say I told you so down the line. That's the point of it. That's why we watch sports.
It's a great point, right? Because what do you think would have been more fun for Canucks fans? If you guys had ranked Quinn Hughes as like a top three defenseman at the beginning of the year, or spending all year making tier 3B jokes, right? Like clearly it was spending all year making tier 3B jokes was more fun.
Right. And to me, what is like, let's see. Okay, so we're giving them a 30% chance to win this series. Doesn't that just seem like they're tier 3B of contenders? Like they're live right now? Like, come on.
Oh my God.
I love that. I love that spin.
Oh, 3B or not 3B. Sean, with how the Oilers played against the Kings, how do you rate them relative to the two teams on the other side of the bracket in the West, right? Like, give me your tiers, the non-Canucks teams remaining in the Western side of the bracket, Dallas, Colorado, and Edmonton.
I'm trying to, like, just stick with the Stars just, like, until the bitter end because I picked them at the start of the season. So I want to say that, they're kind of in a class of their own. I don't know. You look at how good Edmonton's been since Knobloch took over, right? They're the best best winning percentage or highest points percentage of any team since that change was made. And this isn't like a small sample size either. Like they've been one of the absolute best teams in the league, you know, since January. Right. So I think, you know, that's persuasive to me. And then you look at the stride that someone like Bouchard has made, you know, those are the sort of things that happen to kind of help you differentiate this season's Oilers versus even last, right? Like players have gotten better. Things have improved. They're certainly deeper. You know, there's more guys in the middle six that can do some damage there. So to me, like right now, I would put them with the Stars and then like a half step behind those two teams, I would put the Avs, because Georgiev, for as good as he was against Winnipeg and for as much as they got from guys like Nichushkin and Lekkonen and whatever, I think the depth in the goaltending still scares me a little bit too much to say that Colorado's, you know, tied with those other two. So I'll have Dallas and Edmonton in tier one, and then, you know, drop Edmonton down, or, you know, or drop Colorado down, you know, a half tier, however you want to put it. Mm.
So, I mean, you know, as you build out your tiers there of Colorado lower than Dallas, of course, that's the other series that gets going tonight in the Western Conference. And I think fair to pick Dallas in that series. What do you think Colorado needs to do to give them problems or potentially take that one?
I think they need to keep getting, I mentioned this a couple minutes ago, but it's true. I think they need to keep getting a lot of like major production from that. You can't say second line players because of where Lekkonen like sits in the lineup and all that. But I think if you look at the second layer of players, you know, the Nichushkins, the Lekkonens, guys like Miles Wood chipping in a couple goals and all that. I think that's the biggest thing is you need those dudes to continue, you know, at least counterbalancing some of the scoring depth that we've seen from Dallas, you know, because that's still what the Stars have going for the most is, you know, really three lines that can get it done in one way or another. So if Colorado has, you know, some kind of answer for that sort of depth, you give the McKinnons and the Rantanens and the McCars of the world a chance to, you know, not have to do it every single moment of every single game. I think that's what the most important thing for Colorado is. And I think that's a big part of the reason that, you know, they made pretty light work of Winnipeg is because those guys were contributing. So, you know, they look, you know, when they're clicking on all cylinders like that, they're nasty. And I think that's what we need to see from them over the next, you know, week or two.
And out east, Boston, with the quick turnaround after the Game 7 win against Toronto, goes out, puts 5 up on Florida. Is this just kind of a, like, one-game momentum adrenaline bounce for Boston? Obviously, they're heavy underdogs. I think Florida is a pretty popular pick to represent the Eastern Conference in the Stanley Cup Finals. I just keep looking at Boston being like, how do they do this? How do they keep winning? They don't seem that good. Am I going to be saying that for the rest of this series as well?
If Swayman keeps looking like this, man, you might. Because that's what it is, right? Like, he's, you know, I know there's plenty of other storylines, you know, to pay attention to. But we need to start taking a little bit more notice of the body of work that dude is putting together, right? Like, he's been a 950 in a bunch of games. He hasn't allowed more than 2 goals in any start. You know, he's been great. And I think, is that a surprise that we're sitting here talking about the Bruins getting it done with goaltending? Like, no, that's how they operate. But that doesn't detract from the fact that the dude has been really, really good. And I think even last night, you know, he's a big part of why, you know, they have, whether it was a bounce, whether it's something sustainable, it doesn't really matter. They're up 1-0 and the goaltender hasn't been bad, you know, and when that's the way it goes, when you have a guy who's clearly locked in like that, who's going to give you a chance in every game, like, you can get away with a lot of other stuff. You can get away with having Charlie Coyle and Pavel Zacha is your top two centers, right? Because it is. It's corny, but it's true. It's the great equalizer.
With how that game went last night, and it's sort of like Brazeau and Mason Lorge, and it's like, who?
Yeah.
Who? What? How does Boston keep doing this?
Boy.
Is it just goaltending? Like, in your view?
I don't think so. I think Tim Montgomery is a really good coach, and I think that's, You know, and also we've seen it from Boston just historically, right? Like, Lauri, I look at him and I'm like, you know, he's not Torrey Krug, but we saw Torrey Krug emerge a million years ago as this kind of like random defenseman who's skating around and doing fun things with the puck and scoring big goals in the playoffs, right? Like, that's how Torrey Krug made his bones. So I don't know, man. I don't know if there's a pipeline of guys like that, you know, to that team, but there's just something about it. And it's here's sort of the way I look at it, though, is like, they have a bunch of random guys in their lineup and someone has to score goals. So, you know, like there aren't a lot of teams that are playing giving big minutes to Mason Lauris of the world, right? So the more guys you have in the lineup, the more random guys that are gonna pop off like that. So I think that's part of it too. It's just kind of a numbers game. But man, it's wild to see. I did not think they were gonna win that game last night just because of, you know, the way the schedule had broken for them. But here we are.
What's your view of the sort of Bobrovsky bubble, right? I mean, since about 12 months ago, after years, mm-hmm. like 4 years of being one of the worst high usage goaltenders in the league, he's just become excellent. You know, Vezina nominee this past season and probably at least deserved consideration, even though Stolarz outperformed him, has been good in the playoffs to this point. And then last night, like, even before Boston scored, there were some wonky saves, you know, the sort of highlights that people are like sharing, like, wow, look at this save by Bobrovsky. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's not a goaltender is on his game. Like, what are we talking about?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, how do you view the Bobrovsky bubble? Is it something that could be a factor as the series goes along?
I feel like a Bobrovsky hater, honestly, because I feel like whether it's been the regular season over the last couple of years, I was obviously wrong in the playoffs last season. God knows that. But yeah, I keep waiting for it to pop. And I don't know if I'm like docking points because of stuff that happened to him when he played for the Flyers or whatever, but it's still just like, it's just hard for me to buy into him as this brick wall playoff performer. Like, oh, you're going to have to find a way to beat Sergei Bobrovsky. Like, I can't quite get there with him. And I know that's like in the face of an unreal run last year. And, you know, I whatever, we can debate whether he deserved to actually be nominated for the Vezina this year or not, but he's there. Like, at some point, the body of record or the body of work, you know, just becomes what it is. And you got to just accept the fact that this guy is, you know, consistently really good. Man, I'm just not there yet. I'm waiting for the bubble to pop, I guess, is probably the shortest way to put it. Like, at no point would it ever surprise me to watch Sergei Bobrovsky go out and single-handedly lose a few games. So I don't know if that's quite where we are, but I'd never be shocked by it, honestly.
Last series that we haven't mentioned yet, Carolina and the Rangers, game two tonight, New York up 1-0 in that series. What do you expect to see from the remainder of this one?
Oh, man, that feels like it's going to be a long one, doesn't it? Like, I think at the start of the second round, I think that would have been my pick. If you were like, let's go with one series that's, you know, you got to pick one to go to seven games. I feel like that's it. Because they're just like, they're two sides of the same coin. You have, you know, Carolina is the five-on-five dominance that we've come to expect from them. And then you have New York that's like killer power play, awesome shooting ability, awesome goaltender. Like, I think they're just, their strengths play against each other's in such a way that, wasn't surprised to see game one be close, and I'm not going to be surprised to see, you know, something kind of similar in game two. So that's a fun one, and I feel like we should be able to count on, you know, some back and forth there throughout the course of it.
As we await puck drop in an Edmonton-Vancouver series that promises to be absolutely unhinged, if you're following along mm-hmm. on a second screen, my fear for this, Sean, given how punishing the Oilers' power play can be And given that Rick Tocchet's already spent a lot of time in the media talking about, like, hopefully they let us play. Embellishment. You know, I hate embellishment. Like, we're already sort of starting this. So you know how both fan bases are going to react at every call and every non-call.
Is that like...
I mean, I'm just like, one last tears for you. How far and away more annoying do you expect the second experience to be following this series than the other three?
And also, like, I mean, it's going to be more annoying no matter what, but also it's going to be even, you can level up. Like, if this series gets decided on power, on, like, special teams, like, if there's some kind of crazy disparity, not just with goals, but with chances, and, you know, that's what we're talking about at the end of it, like, you're taking what's guaranteed to be, you know, a totally unhinged, you know, pair of fan bases, like, on their best day. But if we're talking about penalty calls and power play, you know, to, like, if stuff gets decided there, man, it's going to level up. So I'm rooting for it. You know, let's get some of that. Let's mix that into the narrative for the series, right? Where we're talking about embellishments or penalty disparities or whatever. I'm like, I want everything I can get from this one, because tracking it, man, it's been fun already.
One person's annoying is another person's enjoyably chaotic, and I think that's what we're headed for in this series.
Correct.
For sure. But Sean, thanks for doing this, man. We'll chat again soon.
All right, boys, sounds good.
That is Sean Gentile from The Athletic. And by the way, we brought up Mason Lowry scoring the goal for Boston, like, and just like this got unheralded relatively. I mean, he was a second round pick a few years ago. He's like 6'5" defenseman all over the ice. Incredible snipe on his goal last night. Like, just beautiful top shelf against Bobrovsky. And it is one of those things where it's just like, where do these guys come from? How do they just keep this production line of super annoying, super enjoyable players coming in Boston? I don't know how they do it, but he's awesome. Yeah, I was watching that game last night. I was like, this guy's wicked.
You can tell why he flew relatively under the radar, given the way he moves, his skill set, and size. And it's just that there are moments where it looks so awkward, like the boarding non-call, which was really just a battle that he's decisively lost so badly, and the refs weren't going to call Holmberg for winning a battle too decisively. And then it became a controversy because the worst part about that one was people were showing the clip that was just when Lore hit the wall, as opposed to the fact that they'd been engaged, like, from behind the net. It had been like a lengthy physical battle. And like by the end, Lore is just like holding his stick. There's a few moments like that every game where you're like, man, this guy's going to be so good once he figures out, like, once he gets, like, just, like, more mature in terms of his body, in terms of his core strength, because there are so many moments on the ice where I'm like, ooh, is he going to get up? Like, ooh. But, man, he's legitimately good. And you know how much I like Brizzo.
Yes, of
course.
Brizzo's,
like, a my guy, so... Love to see him doing well, scoring a highlight reel goal.
We gotta take a break, but hasn't it been fun to not talk about the draft lottery at all on the show?
It has.
What a nice change.
You know, usually...
What a nice change.
Usually it's like, I get 3 weeks off, and then draft lottery night's like the night I'm preparing for like a week.
Yeah. And it's so funny because it's like, it's just pure probability. There's no like, there's no analysis. It's like, we know what the chances are of everything happening going in.
And then every year I write the same column. Luck won't help the Canucks get back on track. You ready for this?
You just do like control F, find and replace some various different references. I'm joking.
I'm just saying that's like the general sense of it. It's like one day I really do hope that I get to write the like, for once the Canucks had some luck. My God. That'd be great.
All right. Joining us next. Really,
maybe the Gavin McKenna draft. Let's go. Fingers crossed.
Oh, man. They got to start trading for those 2026 first round picks. Can you imagine? What a moment for the show it would be. Let's go. All right. Kevin Woodley from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine joins us next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Mike Halford
and Jason Brough.
Join us for Halford and Brough in the Morning weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. on Sportsnet 650.
Or on demand anytime through your favorite podcast app.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And momentarily, we're going to be joined by Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. Not quite yet, though. We'll get Kevin on the line here in a second.
Classic and, goalie, making his own schedule.
Classic goalie. No, we love Woodley. But goaltending, I mean, as
classic goalie, we'll call around to find another one.
As Gentile said, right? Like, goaltending, I mean, it's always kind of a, hey, what does this team need to do to win? Get great goaltending. Like, that'll go a long way in a playoff series. But the matchup in this one, with it being the third string goalie for the Canucks, going up against the firepower of Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, like, I think the interest in the goaltending situation is heightened even from where it normally is going into this series between the Canucks and the Oilers.
Well, yeah, for sure. Plus, Canucks fans don't think Stuart Skinner's good, and I'm pretty confident that Kevin Woodley thinks he's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into that angle, yeah, part of it as well.
So
with Woodley is the Edmonton side of it.
100%. You know, Skinner's been durable and more than functional, right? Like, he's actually been above average, frankly, since he took over from Jack Campbell, midway through last season. He's been above average. Like, he's had some shaky stretches, especially early on this season, although there was more going on in terms of what the Oilers were surrendering. But, you know, for the most part, like, he was fantastic. He had some of the best numbers in the league for an extended stretch in the middle point of this season, like 3-4 months. There were moments where it was like the top five goaltenders in the league over like a 3-month stretch were like Stuart Skinner, Hellebuck, Demko, and Joey DeCourt. So anyway, I'm sure we'll get Woodley shortly, and I'm really curious to see what he has to say about the Netminders and about Demko's status for sure.
Man. Yeah, that's the other part of it, right? Is just what goes into that decision. I'm bringing Thatcher Demko back. And, you know, I'm curious to hear from him also. And we are trying to get Woodley on the line. Hopefully he'll be able to join us momentarily, and we can, you know, stop previewing our conversation with him and have our conversation with him. But, you know, it's one thing for Artur Shelovs to come in and look really good in three starts against Nashville and pick up two wins. And, I mean, he was phenomenal in game six, I thought, against...
Yeah, he was.
Against Nashville, so that was awesome.
That was like an old school goaltending duel. Both goalies were making outrageous stops.
Yeah,
so
it was fantastic.
Fun.
And but you know, like, one of the ultimate questions with goalies, whether it's playoffs or whether it's regular season, is extending a run beyond, you know, a few games, right? Is okay, keep it going on a consistent basis when you're the clear cut starter, which, you know, Artur Shelovs is going into this game. Not that that couldn't change going into this series, I should say. Not that that couldn't change, but he's clearly the guy right now.
When I'd add this, it's one thing to be the clear-cut starter, and it's another thing entirely to be the clear-cut starter in a playoff series against an elite offense that has time to adjust to you, right? I mean, sure, if you're playing every game in the regular season, teams sort of build up a book over time. But in a playoff series, like, what happened to UC Saros after Elias Lindholm beat him once blocker side off the rush in game one, right? Everything was blocker, blocker, mm-hmm. blocker, 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 right? Saros is short. Canucks are just like layered traffic, screens, right? Really relying on getting in his grill and making life hard for him. The moment you show a crack, NHL shooters are just going to try to exploit it and exploit it and exploit it until you break or fix it. And so, you know, what happens over like 20 games in the regular season happens in a period in the playoffs, because it's one matchup against one team, and in this case, one team that knows exactly how to score goals.
All right. Woodley apparently caught up in some media duties down at Rogers Arena, so hopefully we're going to be able to get Talk It On. We're going to be able to get Woodley on
at 1:30. But we're going to do Talk It Audio now.
Well, nope. We will. Oh, excuse me. I misread the email from Batch, which says Talk It Audio to follow. Sorry. My bad, guys. My bad. So... everything going
killing
wrong
it. Hey,
us.
Look,
everything going wrong for us here.
We're
on the show.
We're trying our best back here.
Yeah, no, it's not you.
No, that was my fault.
It's on Jamie.
That was my fault.
I thought you were taking. He was taking accountability, not throwing you guys under the bus.
I thought I saw the email from Batch with audio, and I thought it was like talk it here, but it says talk it to follow. So I thought we had talk it audio
talk it to
go
follow.
To, but we do not. They're talking to him right now, and that makes sense. And that's what Kevin Woodley is doing. He's talking to Rick Tocchet as we speak.
Awesome.
Jealous. What a thrill.
So, did you see the Pearl Jam letter last night? Pearl Jam wrote a letter to the Canucks.
Yes.
And like specifically single out Rick Tocchet, which, you know, along with Charles Barkley being like, my guy, Rick Tocchet, close personal friend of mine, Charles Barkley, Rick Tocchet. Do you read the same thing? Like, what is Eddie Vedder calling out Rick Tocchet because there's a personal relationship there? I kind of think so.
It's certainly a possibility.
It certainly seemed implied by like the go coach Tocchet. Like, what? Like, people don't usually root for coaches like that, right? Am I
no.
off my rocker?
I think like the hometown team shout out is obviously totally common.
Yeah.
But you're right to extend it specifically to the coach when it's not like, you know, Pat Riley or, you know, Bill Belichick or like a huge name brand coach,
yeah.
right?
I just think Rick Tocchet has a lot of celebrity friends. Just another thing that's cool about Rick Tocchet.
Rick Tocchet's awesome, man.
Yeah. No kidding.
He seems like a really cool dude.
He like gathers large groups of celebrities and they do puzzles.
Rick Tocchet's puzzle club.
Yeah, Rick Tocchet goes to like Michael Rubin's white party, you know, where everyone wears white,
yep.
all the NFL players and stuff, and everyone's like, hey, puzzle guy.
Rick Tocchet at the Met Gala. What do you think Rick Tocchet would wear to the Met Gala?
Literally a jigsaw mask.
The Doja Cat towel, I think.
This is peak. Too many games or too many days before game one of a series conversation,
well,
right here.
And guest otherwise indisposed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're doing our very best.
I thought this
best,
was
guys.
Good content.
No,
I don't
it's
know
fantastic.
What to tell you.
No notes. No notes
I
whatsoever.
Killing,
all right. But to get back into.
Lots of people in the inbox saying they like my laugh.
Yeah, that's our most common text. Just inundated every day.
It's more like a cackle.
Laugh more.
People love it.
To get back into looking ahead to the Canucks and the Oilers game one going tomorrow, and you know, before you joined the show, Drancer, when I was doing it at 11, I started off the show by kind of asking people what they're most excited to see, just like not even like, hey, what you think's going to happen, what would be awesome if the Canucks do, what are you most excited to see in this series? And what I was saying was I think this is just an incredible opportunity. I made this point a little bit with Gentile when we had him on as well, but I think this is just an incredible opportunity for the Canucks to kind of put all the lessons they've learned from Rick Tocchet, and they've kind of shown us on the ice step by step and built a new identity, and now they have a chance to kind of prove how real that is, prove how far they've come against a really challenging opponent in the Edmonton Oilers. And I think that like that's exciting. It is exciting to watch a team you've been following, a team you've been cheering for if you're a fan for a long time, have the opportunity to accomplish something hard against a good opponent. And I'm just, more than anything, like I can't wait to see how they meet that moment.
Yeah. And you know, one thing the Vegas odds do reflect, right? Because it's not just the series odds. Like, it does go beyond that to some extent. It goes to
Stanley Cup odds.
It goes to how this team is viewed just generally by hockey fans and, you know, by hockey fans and by bettors and by people who watch and talk and think about the game, right? So, you know, to win outright odds, the Canucks are 15-1, right? They have the lowest odds of anyone remaining in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And in fact, the highest odds, reflecting the fact that the Edmonton Oilers are such heavy favorites, are the Edmonton Oilers, who have better odds than the Rangers and the Bruins, who both won a game in their series already.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, from a standing start, Vegas views the Oilers as favored more heavily than they view those other teams. I wonder if that's true to win series, too, and I'm going to quickly check. Yeah, so having lost game one, the Panthers are a pick'em now with the Bruins, and having lost game one, the Carolina Hurricanes are a pick'em. So that's wild, right? They have better odds of winning their series, even though they've already dropped a single game. So there remain questions in the books, which we look to as just like objective measurements, right? Not because the markets are perfect or super efficient, but just because they're set by sharp handicappers. And then if the handicappers are wrong, the lines adjust because it's a dynamic marketplace, right? So it's useful information to avoid the sort of spot that this Canucks team was, for example, when they fired Travis Green and Jim Benning, where they were like, we were shocked by our start. And it's like, you entered the season plus 200 to make the playoffs. What are we talking about here? Right? So I like to keep this in mind. And what the market is generally telling us is that bettors, people with skin in the game in evaluating hockey teams, right? Not just opining to their buddies on a bar stool or texting into the 650 Dunbar Lumber inbox, but actually like putting hard currency behind their opinions, don't view this Canucks team as a contender, right? Beating Nashville did not change the market's view of this team as like not an inner circle contender, even though, you know, they're obviously a good team, right? Beat Edmonton, and I think that story begins to change. Lose to Edmonton, and the conversation is going to be something like, well, how close was this team really? I do think that those are material stakes here in terms of how this team will be viewed from outside the market and probably from inside the market too.
Well, especially depending on how the series goes, right?
That's
like,
a good point.
Because there's ways to lose close and for people to come out and think like, man, they were right there. Well, they were equals with the Oilers.
And there's ways to lose lopsidedly and still lose in seven games. Obviously, Canucks Vegas stands out from the bubble. But like, I'd bring up Seattle, Dallas.
Right.
Seattle got to game seven against the Dallas Stars a year ago. How wild is that to say, given how they've looked, how both teams looked over the course of the season? But that game seven, it looked like they could play 180 minutes and the Stars never would have scored. Or sorry, the Kraken never would have scored. And that was a pretty significant preview of what we saw in October and November. So, you know, there's ways to lose close or there's ways to lose in a long series and it's still not close. And that's worth keeping in mind too.
Yeah, for sure. But I do think your point about the stakes and kind of how people will regard this team and you know, I think how they'll be regarded and what becomes feasible going into the offseason, right? And how management wants to approach the offseason and kind of push for that, taking that next step as a contender. I think a lot of that could be informed by how they hang in this series against the Edmonton Oilers as well. And, you know, somebody else texted in about being excited to see the matchup between JT Miller and Connor McDavid if we do, in fact, get that matchup. And, again, I think that's a very fair thing to be excited about. And that doesn't mean you're kind of blindly assuming that JT Miller is going to do the job against Connor McDavid. But again, like, who embodies the defensive turnaround for this team that they've had under Rick Tocchet more than JT Miller?
Oh yeah.
Nobody. It's him, right? Like that he is the symbol of how far they've come in terms of defensively reliable, responsible hockey. And again, he's got an enormous challenge. But this is why you want to be here, to take on these challenges.
Okay, so let's set the parameters of what we want to look at here. JT Miller head to head versus Connor McDavid, just for fun. Like, let's look at how it's gone in the past, right? But given the changes that this team has had, like, do we just want to look at it this year, or do we want to look at it larger sample? Because this year is different. Like in past meetings, you know, he probably wasn't necessarily playing center.
Yep.
Like, you know, if we go back multiple seasons, on the other hand, you know, we're still looking at tiny samples here. Like, if I go back 3 years, I'm talking about 75 minutes, McDavid versus Miller head-to-head. So let's just do that, right? It's not perfect, but at least it gives us, you know, a game and most of a period worth of sample, okay? So McDavid and JT Miller have actually been a pretty frequent hard match. So in their games over the last few years, 75 minutes head-to-head, only 55 minutes away from one another. So historically and across multiple coaches, because this sample, 2021 to 2022, also includes Travis Green, typically Canucks coaches have trusted Miller to be the guy out there against McDavid. The Oilers have outshot the Canucks 68-39 in those minutes and have out-attempted the Canucks 91-56. Shots are 53-27. Excuse me, I looked at the wrong column. However, so this is interesting. The Canucks have outscored. JT Miller has outscored McDavid in their head-to-head five-on-five.
There you go.
6-3.
Whoa!
Pretty good. Got to see the PDO on that. 1,166.
It's pretty good.
Oh, baby. Just need 943 goaltending and a 22% conversion rate, and you got him.
Perfect. That's what the Canucks do best.
How incredible is that? I guess they must always be on the ice when the Canucks are leading or something. Like, that's wild, man. That's so wild. I'm glad we did this.
So what you're saying is he's the perfect guy to completely shut down and neutralize Connor McDavid.
He's certainly the perfect guy to get the result, no matter what the actual flow or run of play looks like.
And again, like, it's a special challenge. It's a chance to author a special moment for JT Miller going up against Connor McDavid. Okay, we'll play Rick Tocchet here. We just got it in, hot off the presses from Rick Tocchet after the team practiced at Rogers Arena. Kevin Woodley joins us in the next segment. So here is Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet.
Yeah, just a little bit of the weather. I think a head cold or something like that.
We always talk about, you know, learning to win. What do you think the lesson you guys learned, a lot of your players learned in the first round? Because I know yesterday you talked about guys being a little bit more comfortable, more relaxed. What was the lesson you think learned for your guys?
Well, it's hard to win, and obviously in the series was tough. There was some some moments where we you know, you can't give up. You know, we obviously came back in that game. You know, the PK was great. Like, there was some times where, you know, a goal here or there could change things. I thought we hung in there. Timely goals, obviously good defense. I just think it's a lesson that sometimes you're gonna have to grind out wins. It's hard to win. You know, things aren't gonna go your way sometimes. And I thought we hung in there. Didn't score a lot of goals, but we won the series. Now we move on to the next series. That's what you got to look at that way. Every game and every series is different.
When you watch a guy like Ian Cole, you can see his playoff poise. You may not be the fastest of foot, but he always makes that clean pass out of his own end. Hangs on to the puck for another second or two. How much of that is going through the process of all those playoff series, and do you think that rubs off and guys learn from that?
Yeah, well, I know Kohler from even the – and I think I told you this when we played the Penguins. I mean, we played Nashville. It was 16 or 17, I can't remember, but there was a sequence when he blocked three. We won the 1-0 game, but all I remember is him blocking three unreal shots. The same thing. It was a pivotal part of a game. He took three shots, I think one off the chest, collarbone, and one off the head. That's Ian Cole. You know, he'll do whatever it takes to win. That's why we went and got him, and playoff experience, right? That was a big – you should have saw our bench after the game. It was like, I forget who scored that game. I don't remember all the stuff, but I do remember those three shots that he blocked.
Any closer to a decision on goaltending?
I talked to Clarkie about 4 o'clock today. I keep saying that.
Perfect timing.
I know.
At 23 years of age, I mean, you know, how impressive is what Artie's doing at this young of an age? And sometimes is it better to maybe not know what you don't know?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's, you know, the more you think, sometimes you get in trouble. I don't think he thinks. I think he just, you know, hey, you're playing or you're practicing or whatever. Hey, we're going to do this. Come on the ice early. He just does what he's told, and I don't think he's thinking too much. I think he's, you know, I don't know. He's just a guy that just comes to the rink every day and does his thing.
We know how talented they are on their power play, but when you look at just how they move and operate on the power play and the number of options they have, how difficult is it to defend all of it?
Yeah, I the options or the set plays they have aren't the difficult part. It's when, you know, they beat pressure and they attack. Like, they're so underrated. Like, I mean, everybody talks about their talent. Yeah. I mean, McDavid's unreal. We all know that. But their attack mentality is as good as in the league. You know, they once they sniff something, it's there. Backdoor play, slot play, Bouchard one-timer. That could happen in one play, so you have to be ready for it. You got to pick your poison and give them one of the hopefully the least, you know, dangerous play.
You want to describe your power play goal with Henrik at the end of practice?
It's 2 feet in. It's a classic goal.
Yeah, defending, we all understand it's five guys, not just the two defensemen. Yeah. But as a group, do you think that's the best your blue line group has looked this year in that series against Nashville?
Yeah, it's fair to say. I mean, I think all year the D has been somewhat of a fabric of a team, you know, the way we play defense, but I thought they did a great job with the interior. I mean, you know, when dash all their chances. Artie was there for us, or Casey, or Demmer. But for me, they did a really good job of protecting the high danger interior stuff. I thought that was probably their best. Yeah, I would fair to say.
And obviously, the Oilers are another animal, and nobody, there's only one McDavid, and there's only one Dreisaitl as well. So that's a different challenge. But Nashville, from the All-Star break to the end of the season, was actually ahead of Edmonton on goal scoring, ahead of them on power play. Are there things that you achieved in the Nashville series that you think can translate or give you more confidence about going against Edmonton?
Well, I think those stats help. I mean, it helps us think, hey, man, Nashville, you know, they're right up there with Edmonton with the offense the last half of the year or whatever, 30 games left. So that helps the psyche. But, I mean, obviously Edmonton's conversion rate, you know, two-on-ones, three-on-twos is pretty high. I mean, so you got to limit the odd man rushes because, you know, you give them enough, their conversion rate. Other teams, you know, maybe not as much, but this team conversion rate is really high.
Rick, you guys were a dominant team on home ice all season long, and yet you only won one game here in the first round, but you won all three out on the road. What do you have to do to make home ice an advantage, or is it you get to this stage of the second round, they're all good teams, and maybe, you know, screaming crowds are the same in both places. Like, maybe the advantages aren't as big as you want to believe they are.
Well, I just felt on the road compared to the home in this series, I liked our starts. I mean, actually, the one game where I start was just average, but I didn't mind our game. And then if something bad happened, I felt our intensity went or kind of went down a notch. I think on the road we just kept the same mentality. I don't know if we disappointed the fans or something. I don't know what it is, because the fans never wavered. They were loud even when we were down 3-1. So no, I don't know the reason why, because, you know, this is a pretty good building for us to play in. I just don't think if it doesn't go your way, you got to keep your emotions the same. Everything's got to be the same. You can't be a roller coaster at home.
We just talked to Dakota, who sort of agreed that game one he was pretty good and that line was pretty good, and obviously they saw matchups, and I know he contributed on the penalty kill, but he agreed that, you know, as the series went on, there was certainly room for improvement. Yeah. How did you look at his first round, and where can he ratchet things up?
Yeah, I think Dakota gets in trouble when he doesn't move his feet. I mean, we've said that a bunch of guys, right? You guys hear me say it all the time. I think Dakota gets in trouble when he doesn't move his feet. I thought the last... After that first game, it wasn't he didn't play bad. I thought he was fine. But the guys, you know, the way he's played the last bunch of games, in the season, I thought he's one of our best forwards. I thought he was just a little bit slow on his movements. And I thought, like today we talked about that. It was actually, we just saw it play. Same thing, he didn't move his feet. And then he'd come up and he goes, I got to move my feet there. So I think it's just a mentality for him. I think it's the first playoff stuff, right? So maybe he understands now, hey, it's going to be another level and I got to start to move my feet. That's it. I mean, he's going to be fine. I think he's going to be huge for us in this series. Huge for us.
The Miller line was so dominant again last round, and they've been bad for a lot of the season. What is Pews, though, in particular? What does he bring to that line that makes them work so well?
Well, I think there's certain things that he does that helps Millsy. You know, he's the one thing I like about Pius the last series, around the net a lot. And I think that's important. It can't be just Bess. I think that he got a lot of chances. And that to me is in our own end. If Millsy gets caught somewhere, if he's up high, Suits can go down and play center. I think that happened a few times in the series where he was down low and we were comfortable with him because he's good down low. He's a centerman by trade. So I think that helps Millsy instead of, like, I think sometimes Millsy plays with other guys, he thinks he's got to be low all the time, and he makes these switches when we shouldn't, where with when Puce is down there, he's got it. So he can kind of play the wing position for us. I think that helps.
And then just overall, how does Edmonton defend compared to Nashville, and how is that going to affect what you guys want to do?
They're different. They're more in the Vegas, Boston, us kind of defending mode. You know, Nashville is more of a pressure, triple, double up, where I think Edmonton's more like us, Boston, and that kind of Seattle, Vegas kind of mode.
Coach, you talk a lot about the physicality and physically tough. This series, it's going to be There's going to be a lot of mental grind for this. You know, this is a very passionate series with both fan bases. So how, as a coach, do you prepare your players for to not get too high or low and, you know, maybe not check that social media where all of that, all of the negative comments might be coming in?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if guys listen to that stuff, but I you know, to me, you know, we just, you know, you heard Millsy say we got to play our style of hockey. We can't change for different teams. Obviously, Edmonton, we got to tweak some things. Obviously, the neutral zone is, they're one of the best neutral zone teams. They go to the net as good as everybody in the league. So those are two areas that we got to make sure we're clean on. But for the you know, the other stuff, I think you block it out. I mean, you know, the game's played on the ice.
That is Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet addressing the media again before his team faces the Oilers tomorrow in Game 1 of this series. We'll take a break. Kevin Woodley joins us on the other side here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Kevin Woodley will join us momentarily here after he finished up his media duties, talking to Rick Tocchet down at Rogers Arena. And in fact, we now do have on the line, he's a presentation of White Rock Hyundai from NHL.com and InGoal Magazine. He is Kevin Woodley. Kevin, thank you for doing this. How are you today?
I'm good. I apologize for not being available when I said I would be. Rick's scrum started, and as Thomas can tell you, once you're on one side of their makeshift media room, you can't actually get out of that room without walking in front of all the camera people and the people that are working in it. So I had to stick with it and couldn't break to get to you guys. So sorry about that.
No worries whatsoever. You're worth the wait, Woodley. We're excited to have you on the program now.
Jury's out on that.
And I think, you know, goaltending, always a big talking point going into the playoffs. I think especially in this series now for the Canucks, with Archer Shelov's taking over the crease, at least for now, performing the way he did, especially in Game 6 in that Nashville series. What were, like, from your perspective, watching Shelov's in that Nashville series, what made him successful in those three games?
The control with which he played. You know, and we've talked about this a little bit. The year he had in Abbotsford, it's interesting. As much as, like, the big stage and the bright lights and the comparisons, and he's admitted himself that the experience at the World Championships under similar pressures prepared him for this. And yet, to me, the more remarkable thing is that he was ready for this, not so much, you know, because he's been on the big stage before, but after the season he had. Like, this was not the regular season he envisioned. I don't know how much of that was, because we didn't get to talk to him today, he wasn't made available. I don't know how much of that was maybe expecting or hoping or planning to be here in Vancouver and ending up in the American League. A lot of guys struggle with that when they think they're ready for something and they end up at a lower level and don't give it their full attention. But this was, I mean, this is a guy who lost the starting job to Nikita Tolopila for a stretch. This is a guy who a couple of months ago, you know, gave up a goal from center ice. Like, this wasn't the season he expected. And there were things in his game, when I talked to goalie coaches that watch him in the American League all the time, that, you know, a lot of them were like, wow, like, this is the Stanley Cup playoffs and he's in. They're like, this could go sideways in a hurry. And yet it hasn't, because he's played with such control. He hasn't chased. He hasn't been over aggressive. He doesn't look uncomfortable in the moment. And that's usually where it shows up. You try and do too much. And it's really easy to say don't, but it's really hard to do sometimes. And he's done it behind a team that, yes, they're great defensively, but part of being great defensively is you don't see a lot of shots. And that's not easy to do. I think it's one of the things that the Canucks are sort of underrated for in terms of what makes them difficult to play against for opposing goaltenders. Like, yeah, he only had 20-some-odd shots in game five and whatever. It was 28 in game six, and there's a lot of focus on the shots, but they got the double-digit high-danger chances in both. Like, when half of the shots you see, when you're not busy for long stretches, and then half of the shots you see are high-danger, that's tough on a goaltender. And so there's an element of that playing behind Vancouver, you know, down the stretch when Demko was out, they weren't giving up a lot of shots and there were still quality mixed in there. And that's tough. And so the way he's handled it mentally and how that manifests itself in his game in terms of not being over aggressive, not, you know, chasing play out of his crease in terms of his crease movement patterns, like staying controlled. It's all really, really, really impressive. And I think more so because of the season he's had than the stage this is, frankly.
What do you make of the Saravalli report today? Frank Saravalli, of course, of Daily Faceoff, who reported that the expectation, or at least that there's a chance that Demko is working toward and looking at, you know, game five, according to sources. Sorry, I'm just going to read it so that we're talking about the exact right
things. Yeah, because I haven't seen it. I've been working.
Yeah.
So.
Sources say Canucks goalie Thatcher Demko is out through at least game four of this round two series versus Edmonton. Demko has been skating and progressing big week ahead. Earliest possible return is game five, and that is probably pushing it. But game six, seven get interesting if necessary.
So the game six, seven would be about a month out from the date of the original injury, right? It was the 21st.
Yeah, May 20 versus April 21. So, yeah.
Yeah, so around a month. And that sort of matches some of the timelines that were reported early in the process. And it kind of matches some of the things that I heard originally, even as recently as a week ago. And certainly seeing Thatcher, I wasn't there in Nashville, but seeing the images of him and the reports that he was on the ice had me thinking, ooh, wow, he's ahead of that schedule because there's usually a two-week progression with Ian Clark in terms of the things you work through to get back into play coming off an injury. And so I was starting to think, maybe even sooner. Watching that UBC yesterday, I'm less certain. I think if I was making bets, it would be that we don't see him in this series, even if it goes to six or seven. But as Rick Tocchet said, you know, I think on Sunday coming home from the Nashville series, these things can change in a hurry. But for right now, just, you know, I mean, he was on his knees. He was pushing side to side in the butterfly yesterday, but very gingerly is not a fair word. I don't want to go that far, but, you know, like there was no, like this was not ready to play stuff. This was very slow, controlled, deliberate, no explosive to it, no width in the butterfly when he did. I mean, the fact he's on his knees and, you know, able to sort of move in that direction in terms of the knee and the internal rotation that's required to be in a butterfly is a positive for sure. But it's a long way from that to being able to drop into it, you know. And there's a couple of studies that we've referenced over the years in terms of equipment reviews and equipment testing. Dropping into a butterfly is an Olympic clean and jerk. It's like two times your body, like the force required is like double your body weight every time you drop, the amount of force that's transferred into your joints and your lower body. Like it's a violent action. It's not one the human body was designed to do naturally. And so given what I saw, given the fact that we are talking about a second injury to the same knee, as based on the reports on it in a short period of time, I just can't help but wonder if at some point, as much as he's determined to be back, somebody just doesn't say that the smarter thing to do here would be to wait a little longer than this series would allow you to.
I want to move on and ask you about Stuart Skinner. I think there's a sense among Canucks fans that, you know, Skinner is like a weak link for the Oilers, but, you know,
Not at all.
I tend to think he's been well above average since he took over from Jack Campbell midway through last season. What's the scouting report, and how does it sort of commingle or interact with the things that the Canucks like to do offensively, Laird screens in particular?
No, he's like a top five guy since the coaching change.
Mm-hmm.
Like, statistically, since the coaching change, since Knobloch took over, and since they stopped bleeding high danger rush chances at a rate that frankly was the worst in the National Hockey League, or bottom two at least, he has been a top five goaltender. He is not a weak link. He is really good. And hey, listen, there's pressures. Like, this is his second year as a pro, and he's being asked to backstop a cup contender with, you know, some of the best, you know, arguably two of the best players in the world on it, right? Like, in their prime. It's a big ask. I love his mental approach. I love the growth mindset you hear in the interviews after tough games. Like, it never wavers. There's a lot to love about Stuart Skinner and his game. The one spot where it falls off noticeably is when they start to give up stuff off the rush. Like, the strengths of his game are in zone, spot to spot. You start giving up rush chances, which sort of matches how things started in the season. And don't forget, like, I remember, like, a month into this season, after the third time the Canucks beat them, an Edmonton reporter putting on Twitter that Casey DeSmith would be the number one goaltender for the Edmonton Oilers if they had him, right? Like people were writing this guy off like crazy, and it just, the numbers said it was all about what they were giving up. And so if you can generate off the rush, even since the changes, and they don't give up rush chances, but when they do, his numbers are still underwater on those types of chances. And so that is a weakness. In zone, he can play a two-thirds depth. He's a massive goaltender. He moves pretty well. Off the rush, skating's not a strength, right? Like, as odd as that is to say for a professional goaltender, like, it's relative to everything else. It's like Connor Hellebuck, right? Best goalie in the world, one-on-one. Move him east-west, and he's right around league average. And we've seen that pan out in the playoffs. The problem is twofold. One, the Oilers don't give up much off the rush anymore. And two, the Vancouver Canucks don't create much off the rush. So, that's the biggest weakness. It's the only one I would actually consider a weakness. In zone, he's just fine. And I think mentally he's ready for this moment. Things could change, but I don't look at Stuart Skinner at all as a weakness, unless all of a sudden the clock strikes midnight and they decide to turn into a team that gives up a ton off the rush.
So the Canucks don't generate a ton of volume off the rush. We know that they're dangerous off the rush with their one-shot scoring ability.
Yep.
They're really reliant on in-zone play. What does that mean? What's your read on what that means for how the Canucks should go about attacking him?
Well, I think, like, anything in the playoffs, and we've seen this, and I know you, I don't want, like, I can sort of picture you cringing as I say this, Thomas, but traffic tips, the things that they did well during the year that I think they had to go away from because of the way that Nashville's fronted. And blocked. Like, I think they might, I don't see that out of this Oilers defense, which ironically actually is one of the few in the playoffs is actually bigger than the Canucks defense. So they're capable of, you know, playing. They don't make it easy to get to the front of their net. But I haven't done a deep dive on their video, but I don't think they're a team that's necessarily going to front. Would they take that picture out of Nashville's playbook, that page? Possibly. But if they don't, then taking away eyes, even though he's big enough to look up and over screens, catching him in transition into his butterfly out of those, like, that's a way to do it. The other way, when I looked at sort of the numbers and the tape, is in zone at least, is sort of down below the bottom of the circles. There is a tendency at times to maybe get, whereas every time it gets down that low for the Canucks, their goalie's in a reverse VH, they're tucked inside of the post. That's not as automatic for Skinner. There are times where he will sort of square up on those, or at least get rotated enough towards the passer that pucks that move across can get through the low slot line below the hash marks. You know, he can get stuck because it's a big rotation. It's a big move. He's a big body. And the tap-ins on the other side, I think of the Pius Suter goal that sort of clinched the series, but I think of other opportunities that Saros got a pad on because he's so quick. I'm not sure Skinner's getting a pad on all of those. Some for sure. He's got athleticism. But if you can generate sort of low across the middle, and easier said than done, but if you can create those in zone, there might be more of those tap-ins on the other side of it than there was in the other round. The risk, and we've already heard Rip talk about this, is if that pass doesn't get converted, where's it going? It's off the far boards and they're into transition. Like, you have to be so careful about shooting from angles, even if you think that's a way to score on Stuart Skinner, because the risk is you fuel Edmonton's transition game if there isn't somebody that taps it in, or if it gets missed or it goes wide. So, you know, that's risky. Off the rush, when you do get the chances, and we saw Sam Lafferty do this in the big win that sort of helped lock up the division, it's all about against the grain. If you get odd man rushes, it's high laterals, high in the zone, whereas most goalies, you're trying to sort of make your lateral plays closer to the net and get them splayed out. You're playing to the strength of his size. If you do that, you're better to make him skate, move those passes up above the circles, and take one-timers on the other end of them. There's a tendency to sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, and don't tell him I said this, get into the loo flop, where everything's sort of pitching forward as he comes across and he ends up on his belly. It's not every time, but the tendency's there. That, or he slides across to avoid that. And in either case, you can beat that with quick one-timers into the top half on the far side. But off the rush clean, like Lafferty, the against the grain, the sort of, if you're down the right wing, look to go over his blocker. If you're down the left wing, look to put it over, you know, just over the pad on the glove side. Those are shots that have been there when I look at the numbers for a good chunk of the year. And if you get open looks, if they give it up to you, high glove's the spot to go. Save percentage is in the 760s for the season, high glove. And hey, that's not that far off the norm. Like, if you hit those spots up around the ear in the top corner, a lot of goalies have low numbers, but it's by far, you know, compared to the even high blocker in the corner, it's more in the 850 range. It's a 100-point drop, and it's where you need to go on open looks.
With Shelov's against the Oilers, right? So the you remember that Jack Eichel goal? He bounced back from it, but it was that Jack Eichel wrist shot, and it was just like this sort of welcome to the NHL kid kind of goal. You know, he clearly hadn't seen a shot like that at that distance with that velocity taken by a shooter of Eichel's quality. Is there stuff that the Oilers are going to be able to throw at him that's going to, I don't want to say like catch him off guard or that he's not ready for, but just a different level.
Maybe an adjustment required.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, listen, McDavid's speed is McDavid's speed, right? Like, and his ability to move the puck at speed. So if you don't have some backwards flow to match him, like you can't just stick a leg out, because most guys, when they're moving that fast, if they make a lateral move and they get around you, you can just, as long as you can get the bottom of the ice sealed, are they lifting it, right? Like McDavid does, that's what makes him remarkable. It's not just the speed he plays with, but the things he does with the puck at speed, right? And so he's never seen that, right? Like, they don't have that in the American Hockey League, last I checked. The other thing too, and this is one that, you know, we've heard talk about the way the Oilers create on their power play, not necessarily off their sets, but once they miss a shot and they don't regroup and reset, they just attack. And one of the plays they attack a lot out of is McDavid sort of down the left side with speed into sharp angles, and either he will short side shelf you, like he did to Cam Talbot a couple of times in the regular season, to the point where Talbot in the playoffs changed the way he played on his post, specifically against McDavid coming down the left wing. Seeloff shouldn't have to. He can get up to the crossbar in a reverse VH. Not quite, though, with the same sort of perfection that you see out of a Demko. And where the difference can be when he's post-to-post in that reverse, doesn't matter how fast the play is moving, Demko doesn't vary how he does it. And part of that is because he's so damn fast. Like, it's very rare that he gets behind a sequence or behind a player, behind a pass. Like, that's just how good he is. Seelovs isn't quite there. Although all this work with Ian Clark, I was watching him practice. I actually wrote, when I wrote in my breakdown, and then I watched him today in practice, I'm like, man, like, I can't believe how far this has come in just a month. Like, it's so much tighter, so much cleaner. But if McDavid comes down that wing, and you feel vulnerable short side, and you make sure you lift up into that short side, but he, with speed, pulls it back and does a wrap, can you stay within your system and trust how you go post to post without any panic in reach? Or instead of getting rotation, feeling that push leg and just bumping across, do you reach with the left leg first and lose power in the push. That's where the speed of those types of attacks, if you panic at all, or if you feel like you're behind and start to reach, it actually makes you further behind because it limits you physically and how you can get there. And so there were a few times in the regular season, there was one low high play the other way where I felt like he was a little late getting across on it. And then it was a seam pass back through the crease to the far side. So, you know, not many guys are making that save, but he was behind on it because he was behind getting across on the post. It happens to Casey because he plays it differently because he has to at his size. But that's the one thing, especially with the way that power play, like McDavid will get you leaning into your right side post. And before you can even come off it, he's already gone around behind the net and spotted Draisaitl in that bottom of the circle one timer, where not only do you have to get across, but you have to get that thing sealed because he'll go short side shelf. So those are the types of plays where can you trust that you're fast enough that you don't need to sort of come out of what you already do well in order to beat those plays across. And the other one is just that shot from Draisaitl.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to the Canucks players earlier about how, like, why don't more people do that? Why don't we try that play? Because it's so tough on goaltenders to get that short side seal. That's something he's going to have to be very cognizant of because there's a reason it's such a weapon. It's really hard to do, and it puts goalies in a really compromised position.
Woodley, great stuff, man. That was awesome. Fantastic breakdown of the goaltending battle in this series, and can't wait to get this started. Thanks for doing this with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650 was brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or WhiteRockHyundai.com. And yeah, to say the least, learned a lot there from Kevin Woodley.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Draisaitl shot from hard angle and then literally the most disruptive net front guy in the league. So McDavid off the rush.
Yes.
Draisaitl's shot when you're stationary and Hyman
in
the blue
front
paint.
Of the net. Their power play's really good.
Yikes.
It's really good for a reason.
And at even strength. Like they're able to attack using all of those weapons at 5-on-5. It's crazy.
All right, that's the show for today. Tomorrow, finally, we're there. We get to the fireworks factory. It's game day for game one between the Canucks and the Oilers. We will have the full preview tomorrow. Keep it right here on the station. Before that, you've got it on Sportsnet 650.